Your North Carolina Reading Service brings you the Indie Week. John Federson here, reading for our blind and print-impaired listeners this issue, dated April the 7th, 2021. And today's musicians, we really thank them. It's Ye Old Time Tissue and Comb Trio. Actually, you can tell it's two performers, but they bring the third member along as needed to assist to replace the tissues as they get soggy. Right away to our cover story on the Indie Week from April 7th, and it's titled The Hate in Our State, and it's written by Sarah Pequeño. She wanted him to look at her. Kalki Dunn Miller heard him yelling. At first, she thought he was preaching. Then she realized he was shouting at their group, standing outside Olin T. Binkley Memorial Baptist Church near Fordham Boulevard as they held their weekly Black Lives Matter vigil. "It's not about black lives," Miller recalls the man saying. Other bystanders recall him saying, "All lives matter," and using the N-word. His daughter was standing beside him, adding some yas and repeating after her father. He was wearing a Hawaiian shirt and holding a glass bottle. It was July 3rd, and he said the demonstrators were being un-American. He made eye contact with Miller. As he walked away, cursing, she approached him. "I don't know what I was thinking exactly," Miller says, "but I knew I wanted him to experience to see what I was feeling when he was doing that." He looked at her. "What are you going to do, bitch?" he said. He punched her. The then 19-year-old fell to the ground. She remembers holding her head down and punching her more. "All I know is, like, oh my gosh, I could die," Miller says. "Like, it's possible this is how I die." In November, Miller's attacker pleaded guilty to two charges. Initially, the only charge was assault on a female. The second charge, ethnic intimidation, or North Carolina's version of a hate crime statute, was harder to come by. Those charged with ethnic intimidation, a misdemeanor, could receive up to 120 days in prison. It's considered one of the weakest hate crime laws in the country. Kalkiden and her mother, Carol, are working to change that. Lawmakers in both the State House and Senate filed the Hate Crimes Prevention Act this March. Kalkiden helped with a House bill filed March 22nd by Representative Nasif Majid, a Democrat from Charlotte. The bill aims to change the definition of a hate crime, to consider it a felony, and require reporting of hate crimes at the state level. Kalkiden says of having her assailant tried for ethnic intimidation, though he eventually was, "There was a huge hesitation because the law is so poorly written. He literally had to say, 'I am physically and verbally assaulting you because you're black and because you're a woman.'" The Millers made a spur-of-the-moment decision to attend that vigil that Friday in July. They aren't members at Binkley, but Carol has friends there. Kalkiden was feeling the weight of the murders of George Floyd and the Breonna Taylor, coupled with the pandemic cutting short her first year of college. She says, "I was protesting several times, but that took a lot of mental effort to even get myself to do that. I just felt hopeless." Kalkiden isn't a North Carolina native. She spent her early childhood in Ethiopia. Carol Miller adopted her, and she moved to Silver Spring, Maryland at 12 years old. For junior and senior years of high school, Kalkiden lived in Chapel Hill, where she says she felt invisible. And she says, "I think race had a huge contribution to that. I'd take these honor classes, and I'd probably be one of the few black or persons of color in that class. When we'd do group projects, no one would talk to me. I just existed." The assault wasn't the first time she'd been racially profiled in Chapel Hill. One time she was driving through her neighborhood and ran a stop sign. A police officer pulled her over and asked if she had a weapon in her car. She put her hands on the wheel like she'd been taught. She says the officer thought that meant she was trained with a firearm. By the time she made it to her house, she was shaking. When she was attacked on July 3rd, Carol called the police. Calkin thought she was crazy. She says now, I thought it was like they're going to take my ass to jail. Noting the irony in that despite her being a victim, she was worried about being criminalized. The officer who arrived on the scene was a woman and seemed sympathetic. The man who assaulted her, Bart Moody, walked away with his daughter before the officer arrived. A church member who was there recalls two women trying to keep up with him. One was using a walker. The police found Moody at a nearby apartment. He'd changed out of his Hawaiian shirt. Calkin, Carol, and the officer had to drive by to identify him. Carol remembers how friendly the officers who approached Moody seemed to be toward him. She said it was kind of like they were having a little garden party talk. Moody had been convicted of assault and second-degree kidnapping in 2004 and served prison time. The day he attacked Calkin, he wasn't arrested. Emergency responders who arrived on the scene told Calkin she should go to the emergency room just to get checked out. Still in shock, she kept laughing while talking to the doctor. She says, I was like, did this just happen? I knew it could happen. I just didn't think it would happen to me. That's the thing about racism, that day-to-day fear of, is this the day something could happen? North Carolina's current hate crime law is two sentences long. Quote, if a person shall, because of race, color, religion, nationality, or country of origin, assault another person, or damage or deface the property of another person, or threaten to do any such act, he shall be guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor. The ethnic intimidation law was ratified in 1991, 1 year after the federal government required the FBI to start keeping records on hate crimes across the country. The second sentence condemns teaching people how to perform a hate crime. The bill was last updated in 1995 when the maximum sentence was reduced from 2 years in prison to 120 days at most. The law doesn't require the State Bureau of Investigation to collect data on hate crimes, unlike in 30 other states. It also leaves out gender, sexual orientation, and disability. The FBI releases a hate crime statistics report every year, compiled of incidents voluntarily submitted by law enforcement offices. North Carolina has 504 law enforcement agencies, but only 332 participate in the federal collection of hate crime data. In 2019, only 80 of those agencies reported hate crimes. A total of 211 were reported. Hardly any of those led to criminal charges, and even fewer resulted in convictions. The number of hate crimes reported by law enforcement is wildly inaccurate based on what is known from other studies. The FBI's hate crime statistics report listed 7,314 incidents across the country in 2019. The Bureau of Justice Statistics National Crime Victimization Survey, which collects incidents reported and unreported by law enforcement, estimates this annual number is closer to 250,000 incidents, meaning less than 3% of 2019 hate crimes made their way into official statistics. The federal government has legal definitions of hate crimes as well as protections for the victims in these cases, but most of them are tried in criminal court and parsed out by state judges. A hate crime is always an addition to another charge and is largely seen as symbolic. But that symbolism carries weight. Shea Denning, professor of public law at UNC Chapel Hill in 2015, following the murders of three Muslim college students in Chapel Hill, wrote, the naming and express prosecution of a hate crime acknowledges the underlying history of prejudice and discrimination and affirms that such crimes do more harm than the act alone. Dea Barakat, his wife Yusu Abusala, and his sister Razan Abusala were killed in their condo after Craig Hicks, a neighbor, came to their door accusing them of keeping him from his parking spot. They weren't parked in his spot, nor were they hostile. Still, Hicks called them disrespectful punks in a jailhouse interview. Hicks and his wife said the parking dispute was the motive for the killings. So did Chapel Hill police, although they retracted the characterization in 2019. But Hicks had made Facebook posts about how much he hated religion and was known to be hostile toward non-white neighbors. He ultimately received 3 life sentences for the murders, but was not charged under the ethnic intimidation statutes. The families of Barakat and the Abu Salah sisters still maintain the killings constituted a hate crime. The Millers succeeded in adding ethnic intimidation to Moody's charges. As he was walking away after the assault, he turned to 2 white women who were protesting. Pam Swanson, one of the women, recalled him saying, "I'd hit you too, but I don't hit women." Swanson told Carol Miller. Carol told the prosecutor, and she says that's what sealed the deal for the hate crime charge. Moody pleaded guilty to both charges. Kalkadan asked the judge not to consider a prison sentence for Moody due to her belief in restorative justice. She says this made a lot of people, especially older black people, angry, though she is clear that she doesn't forgive Moody. At his case hearing in November, she read a poem for Moody and for all the lawyers who asked her to repeat her account of the traumatic event. She wrote, "Society seems to forget we are human, too. We are somebody's daughter, sister, grandchild, mother, grandmother, lover, and more. We are human beings that give and give, but rarely get anything in return." Moody received probation for 24 months. Again, the Millers' legal victory is the exception, not the rule. North Carolina's statute is weak, and the justice system is often hesitant to apply it. 3 years after the murder of Barakat and the Abu Salas, Senator Jay Chaudhary, a Democrat from Raleigh, filed that Hate Crimes Prevention Act for the first time. It didn't get a hearing. He filed again in 2019. Once again, no hearing. He told the Indy, "I don't know the reason as to why a common sense bill of this kind, a bill that seems to me to really not have a partisan bias, should not at least have a hearing." Chaudhary filed the Hate Crimes Prevention Act again on March 31st, a week after Majid filed the bill in the House and 2 weeks following the shootings of 6 Asian American spa workers in Atlanta. Chaudhary says that to get the bill the hearing it deserves, vulnerable communities will have to, quote, "let their voices be heard." On a recent Saturday in March, Kalkadan and Carol returned to Binkley Baptist Church. The congregation hasn't stopped its weekly vigil more than 10 months after Minneapolis police officers killed George Floyd, and 9 months since the assault outside the Chapel Hill Church. The Millers stood in the center of the group, spread out across a patch of grass along Fordham Boulevard. Some 25 people held signs, waved to cars. Some cars honk as they pass the church. Some drivers hold up their fists to show solidarity. Occasionally, the crowd gets flipped off. The church has a Black Lives banner staked in the grass at the end of the property. Parts of it have been duct taped. A bottom corner has been burned, and the black plastic is puckered and peeled. Kalkadan brought a speaker and played songs by various pop artists, including Beyoncé and Janelle Monáe. Since July, she's been splitting time between college in Greensboro and working on the bill. She had papers due the week of the court hearing. She says she's tired of white people telling her to make something good out of it and suddenly listening to her after ignoring her for years. She's worried that her life is going to be reduced, that she'll always be the girl that got punched, instead of the poet, musician, photographer, traveler, and activist. That's what happens to a lot of black people who are victimized, she says. Breonna Taylor, she says, this is not her narrative. This is something brought on to her by people that control society. They took her life. Same thing with George Floyd. He's not a guy that was murdered by police. He had hopes, dreams. He has people he loves, but that's his narrative. She worries about living in fear. The night of the attack, she slept in her little sister's bed. She gets nervous about seeing Moody at the grocery store. The night before the court date, a man in a white truck threatened to kill her as she drove through her neighborhood. She's taking this stand for her younger brother and sister, who are also black, so they don't have to be afraid. And she says, being young is difficult, but being young black and female is difficult. This is my experience. I'm going to speak for myself. Now, an op-ed column written by Jesse Huddleston. Draw a larger circle. The Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray has a quote to begin this article. I intend to do my part through the power of persuasion, by spiritual resistance, by the power of my pen, and by inviting the violence upon my own body. For what is life itself without the freedom to walk proudly before God and humans, and to glorify creation through the genius of self-expression? I intend to destroy segregation by positive and embracing methods. When my brothers try to draw a circle to exclude me, I shall draw a larger circle to include them. Where they speak out for the privileges of a puny group, I shall shout for the rights of all mankind. Pauli Murray's words have been significant throughout the 20th century and beyond. For quick context, her words shaped the historic influence of notable political figures, including Eleanor Roosevelt, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Thurgood Marshall. It feels appropriate to reference the words from a human rights pioneer who grew up in North Carolina when considering the harmful, exclusive legislation recently brought forth in our state's General Assembly. In case you missed it, on March 23rd, the fifth anniversary of infamous House Bill 2, our state's public servants introduced legislation that targets trans youth in sports. I have to be honest, though, especially after all of the suffering this last year, Pauli's words at face value are hard to swallow. I am a young, black, genderqueer man living in North Carolina doing my best to survive a pandemic. I'm not trying to invite violence upon my own body. Life was already violent enough before COVID-19, especially for LGBTQ plus folks. Data collected across the country showed we were more likely than cisgender heterosexual people to experience sexual assault. Back in 2015, research verified that transgender people were disproportionately experiencing homelessness, unemployment, harassment, psychological distress, suicidality, and more. And even in 2020, during the pandemic, transgender and gender nonconforming people were still being murdered at alarming rates, with trans women of color comprising the majority of the victims. COVID-19 has almost certainly exacerbated these problems, making life seem like an open buffet of collective suffering when our plates were already full. Each particular kind of violence directed at LGBTQ plus folks, whether physical or psychic, is real and persistent. It has not let up at all. With this in mind, it makes me wonder about the introduction of this possible new legislation. What do we really achieve by excluding children, preventing them from participating fully in our communities? Have we all not suffered enough? Do we not deserve better? And let's be clear, we deserve better, especially LGBTQ plus people. They suffer disproportionately, not because we are inherently inferior, but because others are treating us as if we are inferior when we are not. People, particularly those with institutional power, exclude and marginalize us, deny our rights and protections, and regard these dehumanizing behaviors as normal and justified, as if we deserve it, when we deserve better. We all deserve better. This is why Pauli Murray's words still manage to resonate despite the counterintuitive invitation of violence. I think Pauli was somehow willing to invite violence upon herself because she knew she deserved better and recognized the inevitable pain she would encounter in order to birth her visions of community into existence and to bring her noble endeavors from imagination to fruition. Pauli's endeavor to draw a larger circle including the very ones who would exclude her, is a noteworthy challenge to create something we all deserve, to commit to honor our shared personhood, to construct policies and practices that are more creative, inclusive, and humanizing. When I imagine humanizing legislation that draws a larger circle, that makes space for both LGBTQ people and those who seek to exclude and marginalize us, it demands that we all consider what it would take to cultivate real trust and honesty and empathy and accountability and boundaries. In that larger circle, we must face our common reality that we are connected to one another, even when our actions suggest otherwise. In that larger circle, we must accept that we cause suffering when we avoid it at all costs, that there is no promise of absolute safety for anyone, and that we will mess up and cause harm along the way, even with the best intentions. Drawing a larger circle doesn't mean we minimize or glamorize the violence that persists, welcoming it with enthusiasm. Rather, it means we strive to greet it with revolutionary love, creative energy, and courageous fortitude. It means we wrestle against painful principalities, seeking to transform the legacies of violence we have inherited into something better that we all deserve. It means we stop dehumanizing each other and we stretch our capacities to imagine a better North Carolina. We can imagine a better North Carolina, one where HB2 is fully repealed for good, one where conversion therapy for youth is banned. We can imagine a better North Carolina, one where LGBTQ people can find housing, work, healthcare, therapy, education, recreational sports without fear of discrimination, one where LGBTQ plus parents and caregivers don't have to jump through hoops to ensure their children are legally considered theirs. And y'all, we can imagine a better North Carolina, one that we create together where LGBTQ plus people not only survive but flourish, one that we all deserve, where wholeness is a human right for all of us instead of a privilege for a few of us. Instead of returning hate with hate, reacting to violent anti-LGBTQ statements with more dehumanizing violence, I join with Polly and amplify her words. I invite our state legislators to use their political influence and institutional power to draw a larger circle, to commit to rejecting all anti-LGBTQ policies that bring needless suffering, and to introduce and pass creative, inclusive, and humanizing legislation that wholly affirms our shared personhood and cultivates protections and equity for LGBTQ people. That is the North Carolina we all deserve. And Jesse Huddleston, the author, is a board member at the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice in Durham. From Tomasi McDonald now, in news from Durham, a targeted community. Hispanic Latinx residents make up about 14% of Durham's population, yet account for 41% of the Bull City's robbery victims so far this year. The robberies reached a flashpoint last month when Durham police said that 18 Latinx residents were targeted in 10 armed robberies over 9 days. Longtime community organizer Ivan Altamonte came to the aid of one robbery victim who was working at an apartment complex near North Roxborough Road. Altamonte says it was around noon. It was really bad. He was robbed at gunpoint while he was doing some work at the apartments on a ladder. He says the robberies have traumatized Latinx community. He says, when I talk to people in the communities, they're mad, they're angry, and sad. They wonder, why you take away the little money we have? They say, why are you taking for us? We have so little. What may be worse than the robberies has been the police response, Altamonte says. The community organizer says the victim he helped had been robbed of his cell phone, so he called the police on his behalf. They never called me back. Almonte says the police say they're trying to help the community, but the victims feel like they don't really care about them. Almonte says there were more robberies last month than the 10 reported to the police, but people are afraid to call 911 and language barriers make it difficult to communicate. Police spokesman Cammy Michael, however, told Indy that investigators are concerned with what appears to be an uptick in the targeting of Hispanic Latinx residents, adding that the police department has reached out to the community where the robberies have taken place. Information has been sent to the media, they say, including the Spanish-speaking media. Some Latinx activists contacted by the Indy declined to comment about the crimes because of past evidence indicating the perpetrators were Black. A spokeswoman with a Triangle-based Latinx organization who spoke on the condition of anonymity said it's a tricky issue. We have to be very mindful of the perception and being viewed as anti-Black. Alejandra Valadares, who is the first Latina elected to the Durham School Board, described an emerging pattern in the city where economic conditions have tethered working-class Black and Latinx residents to the same low-income communities. She points to small things that have bred crime, like apartment buildings without surveillance cameras, security guards, or adequate lighting. As long as communities are made vulnerable, she says, they'll continue to be targeted. She remembers one particular robbery in a Durham apartment parking lot where a Latinx man was robbed while on his way to a nearby grocery store. A thin Black kid held a gun to his head and tried to shoot him twice, she says. When the gun didn't work, he assaulted him with the back of the gun and broke his jaw. Then he went inside and robbed his wife. The trauma the woman endured, Valladares says, triggers a visceral reaction whenever she encounters someone in public who resembles the perpetrator. It also prompted a dramatic change in the couple's lifestyle. She says they live in fear of what the dark might bring. As soon as the sun goes down, they are not going out. That's not a solution. It's a coping mechanism to avoid the same predicament. Some crimes against the Latinx community have come from within. In January 2019, police sped to a shooting on House Avenue near Lakewood Shopping Center, where officers found the bodies of Murillo Zurito Domingo, 24, and Bertin Vasquez Mendoza, 26, dead in the street. They charged Jose Manuel Vargas Regino, 20, with 2 counts of murder, and Jonathan Cabrera, 18, with 2 counts of accessory after the fact. Valladares says, we have brown boys with guns. It's not just Black youth. And says the challenges faced by Black and brown men correlate with Durham public school suspension rates among students of color. She says, we are not seeing the complexity of this thing. It's not just about race. That's too simplistic. Edgar Verjara, pastor of Iglesia La Semilla, a Hispanic Latinx faith community, says no one in the community has reached out to him about the robberies, but he has spoken with activists who have made it a point to get the word out in the community. Verjara says, what I'm hearing are activists asking people to be vigilant, aware, and to take precautions. If you are a victim, don't remain quiet. Notify the authorities. The targeting of Latinx residents is not a new story in the city. During the late 1990s, with neighborhoods reeling from the crack cocaine epidemic, Durham police reported a spike in armed robberies with young Black men targeting Latinx residents. Police and Latinx advocates at the time explained that immigrants were, quote, unbanked, meaning carrying large amounts of cash rather than depositing money at financial institutions. The problem was compounded by the community being fearful of notifying the police after a crime owing to their immigration status. The Hispanic Latinx population in Durham also grew in the late 90s, creating unease between working-class African Americans and their new neighbors who were competing for their living spaces and jobs. Today, things have improved somewhat, thanks to a progressive, multicultural brand of leadership, but the unease is now exacerbated by an ongoing housing crisis, further aggravated by gentrification and complicated by the pandemic, which has coincided, with an overall rise in gun-related crime. In November, Durham Mayor Steve Shule and Police Chief Sarah Lynn Davis hosted a press conference to address gun violence as the city closed in on more than 800 shootings for 2020. Shule said, quote, "The very tough few months of gun violence was part of a national trend exacerbated by the pandemic. The city was already challenged by a proliferation of illegal guns. But the pandemic," he says, "was now fueling out-of-control gun sales, while further igniting the always volatile illegal drug trade and gang activities. It also is natural to wonder if the March robberies were fueled by a similar ethnic hatred that has targeted Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders across the country." "I don't want to believe that," Vergara, the pastor, says. "I want to believe we're in a better place, hopefully, with the new Biden administration. But we've seen what our Asian American Pacific Islander brothers and sisters are experiencing. I want to say no, but it wouldn't be surprising." Vergara thinks the armed robberies last month were more crimes of opportunity. He says, "My general sense is that, especially with the economy, a lot of Hispanic Latinx residents are essential workers and are being paid in cash and targeted on certain days." Meanwhile, Valladares would like to see a bundle of solutions hammered out by all of the factions of the city to address the problem. As far as she's concerned, issues of equity and access to community resources for young people are key. And she says, "We have to make sure we reach black and brown youth and design and create opportunities for them. We have to make sure every child has an opportunity to see themselves reflected in those opportunities." Julia Hayward now writes a story called Worst Practices. This is about conversion therapy. For 14 months, Stephen Atsila's life was a nightmare. The then 15-year-old Waxhaw resident, who was assigned female at birth, but now identifies as two-spirit, an indigenous term used to describe someone who has both masculine and feminine traits, had been struggling with gender identity along with other behavioral issues. His parents thought it would be helpful to enroll Atsila at Solstice East, a treatment center outside of Asheville for adolescent girls, struggling with everything from ADHD and academic issues to substance abuse and addiction, in 2015. This is where Atsila, now 22, says he was forced to undergo conversion therapy while he continued to struggle with his gender identity. And he says, "I was 10 times worse when I left Solstice East than when I went in." Last week, several Democrats in North Carolina's General Assembly introduced a bill, House Bill 452, to ban licensed professionals from practicing conversion therapy. That's a blanket term for the practice of attempting to alter an individual's sexual or gender identity for practicing therapy on minors. North Carolina is one of 30 states in the country that hasn't banned conversion therapy, and it took an executive order from Governor Cooper in 2019 to prohibit state funding for entities such as treatment programs and churches that performed the practice on minors. Representative Vanetta Alston, Democrat of Durham, one of the co-sponsors, said in a press release, "This legislation will move North Carolina forward and help us build a state where LGBTQ people are respected and protected no matter where they live. Too many LGBTQ people, especially those who are BIPOC or transgender, experience discrimination and violence in North Carolina, and our laws right now leave them vulnerable. Conversion therapy remains legal in every state in the South, with the exception of Virginia, which outlawed the practice last year. Democratic legislators and civil rights advocates say the lack of legislative action to ban the therapy has allowed and even encouraged its use in North Carolina. Its use. But this isn't the first time Democrats have tried to ban conversion therapy. A similar bill was introduced in the General Assembly last year. It didn't just fail. Republican leaders wouldn't even give it a committee hearing. For the first 8 months that Atsila spent at Solstice East, he says that the center refused to let him go by his preferred name and pronouns and would punish any peers who attempted to address him the same way. The staff discredited his transgender identity countless times, Atsila says. They forced him to destroy some of his gender-affirming garments, including binders, and tried to make him wear a bra. After confiding in a peer about his plans to medically transition in the future, Atsila says the staff forbade the two from continuing to speak to one another. He says they said it would be better for our therapy that way, that we would only be able to heal, and this is what my guide told me, if I took my gender and set it aside on a bench and pretended like it didn't exist, so I could get through all my other problems. He said that 4 months after leaving Solstice East, he attempted suicide. The estrangement from his family also left him homeless for a period of time, and he says he continues to struggle with PTSD since leaving that treatment center. Last month, Atsila and others took part in a protest in downtown Asheville where they recounted years of mental and emotional abuse while in the program. Protesters called for the treatment center's closure, and Atsila and others continue to campaign through social media and online resources for Solstice East to shut down. Now, three staff members at Solstice East, including its clinical director, refuted Atsila's account of his time there. Talon Brown, a science teacher at Solstice East, who is also a transgender woman, told Indy, "It's been really difficult for me to hear these allegations because this is just not that kind of place." The group's executive director, Rick Pollard, also denied the allegations that were brought up at the protest. He wrote in a statement to the Indy, "Any practice of conversion therapy is dangerous quackery, which we do not practice, engage in, or condone in any way, and we fully support legislative and policy efforts that prohibit the unscientific and dangerous practice of sexual orientation and gender identity change efforts." With HB 452, even treatment centers accused of performing conversion therapy would benefit from legislation that clearly defines what conversion therapy looks like and provides a way for entities to either prove or disprove their practice of it. Allison Scott, a director at the Campaign for Southern Equality, an Asheville-based advocacy group that works across the South, says, "When we get into a patient says this and a therapist says this, that can't be aired in public for confidentiality laws. But the state licensure boards, they can do these things. But in order for them to do that, they need to have a clear statute or something to go by to say this is happening." Scott, who is a trans woman, says that when she was a minor, her parents enlisted their local church to perform a form of conversion therapy on her. She says, "It was horrible for me at such a young age for people to berate me personally, harass me, threaten me. Even though they never physically did any harm to me, the mental assault that I went through was brutal." Part of the difficulty in drumming up support for a statewide ban is that it's impossible to track how prolific the practice is. Nationally, research from the Williams Institute at the University of California School of Law, Los Angeles, estimates that 700,000 LGBTQ people have undergone conversion therapy, and that another expected 80,000 youth will undergo the practice before they reach adulthood. Research also shows that 4 out of 5 instances of conversion therapy occur at religious institutions, but that very few churches in North Carolina openly advertise these services. The ramifications of conversion therapy can be deadly. A 2020 study from the Williams Institute found that lesbian, gay, and bisexual people who had undergone conversion therapy were twice as likely as those who had not to attempt suicide. Despite these grim statistics, supporters say the outlook for HB 452 isn't much better than it was for last year's anti-conversion therapy bill. Scott says, "There just seems to be a lot of hesitancy for a certain amount of lawmakers for anything that has to deal with client-patient health care or LGBTQ issues." John Autry, a Charlotte Democrat who co-sponsored the bill, says, "The General Assembly's leadership has very tight grips on what bills move and what bills don't." Republican legislative leaders did not respond to interview requests from the Indy. Autry continues, "I've never discussed this with leadership in the House. I've discussed it with other members on the other side. They don't see the need for it. They don't see conversion therapy as a problem or an issue." Jane Porter logs in now. News from Kerry, untitled. In 2008, Maria Rodriguez finished paying for the mobile home she lives in at Las Americas, a trailer park near downtown Kerry. 5 years, thousands of dollars in property taxes, and $2,800 in lawyer's fees later, she finally obtained the title to her trailer. Epifania Basilia Lopez paid off her $20,000 trailer in March of 2016, but has not received her title from Mobile Estates, the company that owns the trailer park. Same with Jose Carmen Rodriguez, whose final bill of sale shows he finished paying for his trailer in August of 2011. Basilio Lopez told the Indy through a translator, "At the beginning, a Mobile Estates manager told me I had to go to the DMV. Then they just started giving me pretexts because they didn't show up when I wanted to go talk to them, and they just gave me excuses. Then they told me because I didn't have a driver's license, I'd have to find someone who did to transfer the title to. My son has a license, but they told me the condition was I would have to pay them another $1,500 in order for them to transfer the title to my son." Dozens of the 300 families who live in mobile estates, known as Las Americas, located off Southeast Maynard Road near the upcoming Fenton development in East Kerry, say they are awaiting titles or trailers they have paid for. According to state law, trailers must be registered with the DMV. Over a year ago, residents and activists approached the state attorney general's office to request an investigation into the missing titles and accounting issues associated with the trailer park's operations. Nazanin Ahmed, a spokesman for the attorney general's office, said the office began investigating mobile estates in December of 2019, and he wrote, "During the course of the investigation, we've been in touch with the park's council on multiple occasions to make the park aware of our concerns and to encourage it to resolve title issues. The park represents to us that it has resolved a few of the title issues." An October 2020 letter from Daniel Mosteller, a deputy attorney general from the Consumer Protection Division, states that 20 titles are, quote, "in progress of being distributed out to Las Americas residents," according to information he received. As of now, says Sandra Bueno, an organizer with One Wake, a nonpartisan, multi-ethnic, multi-issue group of churches, associations, and other nonprofits who is working with the residents, at least 57 families are still awaiting their titles. Byrne Bullard, a realtor at Kerry-based firm Fonville Morrissey Lochmere, owns mobile estates, according to documents filed with the Secretary of State's office. He also owns Mico Utilities, which supplies water to the residents of the 42-acre park, who have been paying $360 a month to rent lots from mobile estates. Bullard did not respond to emails and phone calls requesting comment, including a question about how many titles have been supplied to homeowners since the Attorney General's office got involved. Residents and organizers, including Bueno, say the missing titles are not the only problems at Las Americas. At a virtual protest last month, residents complained of issues at the park, ranging from water shutoffs and unexplained hikes in water bills to fines for parking, for having pets, and for gathering with neighbors, to targeted harassment from the park's managers. When reached by phone Monday, Mobile Estate's longtime general manager, Osvaldo Bastida, told the Indy he had no comment. Paula Tito's water bill normally averaged around $150 per month, according to records she shared with Indy, but in October, she was shocked to receive a water bill of $344. The park's manager, she says, told her she had a leak, but refused to fix it. Tito said her husband changed the pipe himself, but the next month they received a bill of $458. Tito wrote in a testimonial sent to Indy, "In the middle of this pandemic, Mico Utilities has exaggerated with the water bill. Personally, I have had very high bills when I am hardly at home." Las Americas homeowners, including Lopez and another woman, Rosa Martinez, said they and eight other women were illegally threatened with eviction. The Indy viewed a September 2019 letter from Mobile Estates that gives notice that the land the residents rented at the park was not up for renewal and that they would need to vacate the premises within 6 days. The woman took the letters to the Wake County Register of Deeds office and learned that the notice was not valid to legally evict them. Residents are wary of further fines and eviction threats. On March 1st, Mobile Estates sent to the mostly Spanish-speaking residents a notice of termination of their previous leases and a new 19-page lease agreement written in English that raises rent for land at the park by $40 to $400 per month. If the residents refuse to sign the new contract, it states, they will have to pay a month-to-month rate of $475. The contract came with 3 pages outlining violations and their associated fines, including a $50 fine for barking dogs, a minimum $20 fine for parking incorrectly, a $100 fine for noise violations, and a minimum $25 fine for gathering around the central mailboxes. In a March 26 letter to Bullard, Jonathan Patton, an attorney at the North Carolina Justice Center, wrote that North Carolina law mandates the termination of an existing lease, requires 60 days' notice. Mobile gave only 30. Further, the letter states Mobile failed to provide tenants copies of the existing lease contracts when they requested them. The letter asks that Mobile Estates rescind the lease termination letter it sent to residents and not let the rent increase go into effect. It also asks the company to provide the original lease agreements to tenants. Patton told the Indy he has not received a response to the letter from Bullard or other Mobile Estates representatives. Some families, not wanting to pay an additional $75 in rent each month, went ahead and signed the new lease contract anyway. Jose Rodriguez, one of the owners awaiting his title, says, "I feel like I live in a depression right now. You can't do anything. If you do something wrong, they charge you $25 or $100. I already signed the contract because they told me if I don't, I have to pay an extra $75 this month. There's no other way. So we signed a couple of days ago, and I already paid my rent." A article about Martha Waters, author, written by Sarah Edwards. Chapel Hill author Martha Waters writes historical romance novels, just not the kind you might expect. First comes love, then comes loathing. Or wait, was it the other way around? In To Love and To Loathe, a new novel from the writer Martha Waters, years of simmering tension between two members of British high society, the witty, widowed Lady Templeton and the edgy, ungettable Marcus of Willingham, form the basis for a will-they-or-won't-they Regency romp. If you're looking for light, good-natured historical fiction, a la Emily Griffin, set 200 years ago, then Martha Waters may be your writer. The 342-page novel is the second in Waters' Regency Vows series. A Chapel Hill children's librarian, Waters first sat down to write a novel in November of 2018 during a sprint-to-the-finish writing challenge called Na No Raimo, Participating writers commit to writing 1,667 words per day. The fruit of her labors, To Have and To Hoax, was picked up by Simon & Schuster's imprint, Atria Books, with a publication date of early 2020. Those of us with early pandemic releases got hammered by it, Waters laughs ruefully. 1 year later, over Zoom, her cat Puffin pokes his head into the camera frame as she recounts the flyleaf book launch that never was. She ended up doing a release via Instagram Live. Still, the book managed to make a splash. Entertainment Weekly described it as a dizzy, situational comedy with an abundance of heart. Publishers Weekly gave it a starred review, writing, Waters gently lampoons genre tropes without sacrificing genuine feeling. A year later, Waters is celebrating her second pandemic-era release. A native of Florida and a graduate of UNC Chapel Hills with both a bachelor's and master's degree, Waters says she's always had a thing for history, writing, screwball rom-coms, and England. But it wasn't until she was studying library science at UNC that she picked up a historical romance novel by Julia Quinn, author of the buzzy Bridgerton novels, that things fell into place. She says, It was the first time I'd ever read a historical romance novel being published contemporarily. Once I started reading the genre, I did this total 180, from wanting to write fantasy for children and teenagers to want to write romance for adults, and I like Regency as a subgenre. Once you start looking, it's a time-hopping subgenre that's less obscure than you might think. Jane Austen novels have proved inexhaustible for both screen and novel adaptations, from Clueless and Pride and Prejudice to Curtis Sittenfield's Eligible and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, proving that rivals to romance plot has enduring appeal. And Waters isn't the only one who fell in love with Julia Quinn's period writing. When Bridgerton, a Shondaland production, hit Netflix in January, it broke records and was reportedly streamed by 82 million households around the world. It's a modern-feeling watch, bingeable and breezy, with a multiracial cast, pops of color, think of a ballroom string arrangement of Thank You Next, and a lot of sex. Readers seeking more sex will find plenty in To Love and To Loathe. The novel follows a conventional romantic arc, with its main characters exchanging barbs right off the bat. A lot of reproving and withering looks are exchanged, but when a wager enters the equation, and the Marquis of Willingham propositions Lady Templeton with a no-strings-attached affair to educate him on how to be a better lover, things take a turn. Clothes come off, and frankly, some pretty hot feminist tutorials happen from there. This isn't really much of a spoiler. It's fairly implicit that these characters will find their way past the bantering and bedding and into love. More than plot twists or big reveals, Waters seemed most interested in sparkly, immersive storytelling that turns the tables on what we normally get from historical romance fiction. She says, I like adopting a somewhat historical tone for them, but I'm fully aware that these are modern-feeling characters. I want them to be characters that a modern reader can relate to. Historical fiction, she adds, often says more about the time during which it was written than in the time during which it was set. Such is the case for Bridgerton, as it was with Sofia Coppola's frothy Converses and Countesses drama Marie Antoinette in 2006, and more recently the Apple TV runaway hit Dickinson about the poet. Cast against the sexy gloss of prestige television, Emily Dickinson's poems speaks across time. To Love and to Loathe plays into this new anachronistic feminist fantasy with a heroine who doesn't shirk from her sexuality even as she learns to lean into her own longing for love and trust. That's still a pretty subversive proposition. When it debuted in 1998, the freewheeling sexual mores of Sex and the City's Samantha Jones were pretty radical, and that was just some 20 years ago. To Love and to Loathe may represent a fantasy, but it still feels exciting to read about a heroine telling a man how it's done 2 centuries ago and to see a marriage plot stake out daring new ground. And Waters says, I wrote characters that felt right to me. And the thing is, I don't want to write a romance hero who actually behaves the way a man in 1817 would. No, thanks. He'd be a misogynistic jerk. Well, we're approaching the end of our Indie Week availability this week, and I wanted to let everybody know that I'm forced to gloss over or not cover three articles that are, you can find online at indieweek.com if you choose. One is about a stage presentation of a production, a new production of Othello, the Shakespeare drama, rewritten and featuring an all-black, all-femme creative team. And the the award-winning director is Jamaica D. Holloway. And they talk, they discuss racial issues and also a descent into madness and murder at the hands of a manipulative underling, as of Shakespeare's Iago. The next one is another review of or talk about a Durham filmmaker's tribute to her dying mother. It was a New York Times essay. LaRhonda Maginot Bryant evokes the sentiment of that sorrow with death, everything, nothing. And that's been turned into a powerful 6-minute film, writes Tomasi McDonald, and which is going to be streamed coming soon, or not soon, but on March 8th, officials with Aspen Film announced that the poignant narrative has been selected to premiere at its Aspen Shorts Fest. That could lead to Academy Award talk. And finally, Joseph O'Connell, a musician of Elephant Micah, the group, has got a new album coming out, Vague Tidings. And Sarah Edwards interviews him and talks a good bit about the album and various life-related things considered contained with that. And unfortunately, now we can tell that our time is expiring. And how do I know that? Well, I know it because our comb and tissue paper trio is coming back up to play our closing chords. And there's quite a bit of soggy tissue that needs to be cleaned up, and I guess I have to handle the dustpan to clear that up, so I have to stop. And next week, another issue of Indie Week will hit the stands, and we'll be here to read it for you. So long for now.